So today is the second part of my story, and it is, on the one hand, it's more specific science, but there will be a good measure of philosophy still, because no matter what, I mean, we do not do proper experiments in the test tube when it comes to origin of life. We do only in silico experiments. Towards the end of my talk, I will argue that this may become the rule rather than the exception 20 years from now, but we will see about that. For the moment, what I'm going to tell you about is an interface. Since this is evolution and networks, that's what we are here gathered here for a few months to talk about. My talk will be about evolution and networks, but very, very early networks, something that I coined as pre-biology or systems pre-biology. So this is the model that I'm going to describe to you, and it's also depictable as a network. We discussed already the chicken and egg problem, and this again is a manifestation of it. You need proteins to make RNA, you need RNA to make proteins. One way out is to use only RNA. Some other people would argue you can use only protein. If you think about prebiotic chemistry, and we heard from Jeff Bader today a lot about that, it is very unlikely that anywhere on the globe there will be only protein or only RNA. In fact, it is only going to be, it's always going to be a gemish. So we have to live with this idea. It's only a figment of our imagination that in real prebiotic conditions you can have a pure type of chemistry. On the other hand, of course, along evolution, there could have been a time when protein was more important or when RNA was more important. I don't argue about that. The scenario that I'm going to draw to you today is called Lipid World. We've initiated it about 10 years ago, and we have collaborated with Dave Diemer and with others on elaborations of this scenario. Now, the scenario is not only about lipids. First, the word lipid. Lipids means molecules of certain types that have a water-loving head and a water-hating tail. Now, this kind of general chemistry can come in all sorts of breeds and colors, and one of them is what we call lipids. So basically, it's amphiphile world. Amphiphile meaning liking and disliking together, having part that dislikes and part that likes water. So please don't take it as a simplistic term. Lipid is just a symbol. It means any molecule that will do something like making little balls of molecules of its own accord, of their own accord, by spontaneous accretion, and then perhaps undergo a series of steps, chemical and evolutionary, to give rise to protocells. Now, as you see here, molecules of different kinds join the game, and it is always a heterogeneous kind of game, as opposed to the idea of RNA first, then replicators, then a wall joins in, then proteins join in, and then you get a protocell. So it's not only a question of chemistry, but also of philosophy. You have a graded evolution with diverse chemistry all along the line. Another way of looking at this is what we call a graded appearance of lifelike entities, in which while many of us have been thinking along these lines, the red line. The red line is abiotic, 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 an abrupt appearance of RNA-like or RNA replicators, and then from then on we call it biotic. We argue for the point, the green line, that is there are mesobiotic entities halfway between biotic and abiotic or prebiotic, and that this goes gradually to become more and more lifelike. And we also argue that here we have ensemble replication, to be specified immediately, as opposed to single molecule replication.
Why do you have that time scale?
Why do I have it? It's just symbolic.
Particular, why did you choose that RNA?
Oh, you know that RNA appeared 3.55 billion years ago. No, I'm joking. We don't know. We don't know that. It's just to give, this is the time window that all of us agree interesting things happened within, and this, everything else is just a figment of my imagination.
So here, the vertical axis
It's bioticity. Bioticity.
Well, what's the definition of bioticity? What's your definition of
bioticity? At dinner. We all know what it is when we meet it, but we don't know how to define it.
You're putting out in the corner, there was something like ensemble. So are you like thinking of going from an unspecific replication towards a more information preserving one?
Yes. Yes. And this is actually a highlight of my entire talk, just what you said now. And I changed this slide to call this, in line of what we heard from Jeff today, pre-RNA world. So this is a little more acceptable to the mainstream thinkers about origin of life. So maybe there was something before, but what we say, and that's very important, is that what was before RNA was capable of some bioticity, which means a capacity to contain and transmit information upon a procedure or a process that is akin to replication that we see in cells today. I can see Jack Szostak smiling in the corner. I know he doesn't agree, and I'm happy about this, because if there is no disagreement, then where is science? Okay, and we can argue about that too at dinner. So, in my previous lecture, I gave these 11 points. I'm not going to go back to these. I'm going to try to deal with these 6 points as I go along. So this, to me, is more or less solved or less important. But these are important. So I'm going to touch upon first the question of today's chemistry or not. That's very important. Listen, we are looking at something like life today. It's very constrained. We have only about 1,000 different kinds of monomers inside us out of 10^9 different possible monomers of the same kind of molecular weight. It's a millionth of the chemical space. And that's what makes life. How do we dare say that life began with the same constrained 1 millionth of the chemical universe? There were so many other molecules. Now, we look at life today and we say, without the 4 nucleotide bases, without the 20 amino acids, you cannot have life. Of course not. But early on, maybe you could. Maybe you could have some other types of self-replicating, evolving, undergoing selection type of entities that were not made of the same monomers of the same chemistry. And one point in question is lipids. Today's lipids make walls, barriers, outside cells, inside cells, in organelles, and so on. But could that have been different early on? Now, looking at different chemistries is not something that I have invented on my own. If you look at Alexander Oparin, that I also mentioned in my first lecture, he was looking into the question of a prebiotic soup. He took it for granted that there were many, many different kinds of molecules inside. And some of the experiments that were done to look at coacervates, he was using gum arabic or all sorts of things that have nothing to do with life today, or relatively remote from life today. And he was thinking in terms of metabolism first, namely an interchange of chemistries and changing of molecular shapes and kinds in a soup. And DNA and RNA were not mentioned because their role was not yet clear. Although the molecules were known, the roles were not clear at this time. So this is one way of deviating from the dogmatic chemistry that life today is using. Now, as we heard already in the morning, compounds can be formed in situ on Earth, or they can come from outside, and we get relatively similar types of molecules. And as we heard, just as an example for amino acids, you get a few that we have in cells today, in life today, and with them, quite many that are not in life today, coming in, formed by lightning, formed in volcanoes, in hydrothermal vents, and so on and so forth. So there is a large number of molecules, including, as Dave Dimmer has shown very nicely, including molecules that can form these structures, namely amphipholes. These are vesicles that are formed by water-hating, water-loving molecules. So there are such molecules coming in from space. Now, today's lipid chemistry is much more complex than we have thought. This is part of a chart that is taken from a paper on lipidomics. Now, lipidomics addresses the question of how many different kinds of lipids we have, and it's like genomics. It's a very large diversity, but it is still much smaller than possible generally from the chemical point of view. So this is just, these are actually only sphingolipids. So it's a different kind of lipid than the phospholipids that we are usually thinking of, but it is important in life. So you have combinatorics, you have different building blocks, and you can get many, many different kinds of lipids with branches, without branches, and so on, this way. Now you can go much further than that, and that's extremely important. I want to drive this point or message home as much as I can. The head groups today, what are they? There is choline, which is a specific chemical with positive charge. There is an amino acid, serine. You can have a head group of ethanolamine. Very few compounds can form the water-loving heads. Relatively few molecules, usually fatty acids of certain lengths and certain number of double bonds, can form the double tail in the phospholipid, in the glycerol-based lipids. So it's a restricted repertoire. But you can think of anything coming as a head group, and a lot of other things like branched and so on, which we don't have in most cells today, coming as tails, the water-hating tails. Now here in the head, you can have peptides, you can have nucleotides, you can have phosphates, thiols, anything can go there. Today in lipids, some lipids have, for example, sugars here, glycolipids. Some have peptides, proteolipids, but the repertoire is restricted. Maybe early on, there were many, many more, which means that all that we love so much about the chemistry of nucleotides and the chemistry of peptides could be embodied in a lipid world, except that it would be surface bound, which is nice because it helps concentrate and helps interact and so on. So we should think about life's origin as a planet scale random chemistry experiment, much like what people do today when they do drug screening or drug candidates or drug target screening and so on. And it's clear that diversity is cheap. Everything is possible under prebiotic conditions. Some molecules will appear more, less, but there is no guidance and everything can form. So today's chemistry or not, I would say perhaps not, even by statistics. Now the three points that I want to talk about are catalysis by proteins, yes or not, only yes or not, large molecules or small, and sequential or compositional information. These three points are the crux of our lipid world model.
Sorry, one question, but if this is true that we have molecule, ancient molecule, right, which they are different from what we are playing with, trying to understand origin of, especially for the prebiotic life, then shouldn't be better than or useful, important to look for this molecule, We have heard this morning that the amino acid can be, stable in some condition, and these are, units for, peptides and proteins. So I guess if we put more efforts to look for these ancient molecules, to Mars and trying to dip and look for.
Maybe we will be wiser. Okay, you saw the Miller-Urey flask.
Yeah.
Do you remember what Jeff said was there, just as he showed it first time? You remember the word, goo? Remember that?
Yeah.
All the molecules are there.
Yeah.
They are there. We have to find them. We have to look for them. But there is nothing specific to look for. Suppose I said that. Historically speaking, life began with, say, glycerol and this chain and that chain, and here there was a nucleoside, ribose, which we don't have today as a molecule. We could look for that, but that's an elaborate molecule. It may have appeared only in very low concentrations. Maybe we don't know what to look for, because we don't know what life started with.
Sort of hybrid or something which resembles, because it cannot be completely different from what we have today.
What I think is a legitimate endeavor is to look how diverse the goo is. So try to characterize with chemistry that perhaps will be available pretty soon. You can do microanalysis of everything that is there. In this goo, maybe every molecule is different. Well, that's a bit too much. But no, it's not impossible, depending on how big they are. The goo is not only black because it has many double bonds and it absorbs light in the visible, but it is also long molecules. It's like tar. But there are all sorts of molecules, small and large, in there.
The last elaborate a little bit on the concentration problem? I mean, there may be a huge diversity, but how much of this stuff would you expect or even need to really make a lipid world?
Thank you for the question. What is nice about Lipid World, we get something very cheap and for free, and that is a concentration mechanism. What happens is that lipids, or amphipholes in general, tend to form micelles and vesicles. So even if they occur at relatively low concentrations, they find each other. So that's, of course, there can be a problem there. But I also want to stress that we are used to the idea that we need a real large amount, say a nanomole. Nanomole is a lot of material in terms of the number of molecules. If you, it's Avogadro numbers times 10 to the minus 9, it's 10 to the minus 14 or something like that, molecules. Who said that is necessary? Maybe you can start life with aggregates, with clumps that have almost every molecule different. And then a process will begin, which I will describe to you, that might change that already under conditions that signify a measure of selection. I will come to it.
No, I'm afraid to move on. Jeff talked about the prebiotic synthesis of amino acids this morning, and I think people feel, the field feels pretty comfortable that that would happen. You get a lot of amino acids formed. I've never seen a particularly compelling prebiotic synthetic group for lipids.
Okay.
Am I wrong? Are there?
You're right, but on the other hand, Oro did show some processes in which molecules that look like fatty acids would form. And as I mentioned already in a previous slide, some of these fall upon us from the sky. They are in small amounts. But the goo is more in the kind of amphiphilic molecules or hydrophobic molecules than in the kind of hydrophilic molecules. We have just not analyzed it extensively.
Well, one thing I ought to point out about experiments I showed this morning, it's only under reducing conditions that you get that glue. And we do that experiment with CO2 and nitrogen, nothing.
Okay, so we go back to saying that we need reducing atmosphere. But I would like not to, at least for me, it will perhaps be more necessary. But I would like to leave it alone for a moment. Just think of it as a potential problem in the scenario, but let me try to describe the scenario a little more in detail. So random chemistry, and these three points are now to be brought to the forefront. What can be a catalyst? I already mentioned in my first lecture, so I will not elaborate it too much, but just for the newcomers, I will say that in my opinion at least, and I think I'm not wrong, anything can be a catalyst. There is nothing special about proteins except their capacity to fold. Any polymer can fold. Some polymers will fold, many others will not. That's true for proteins and for non-proteins. What is important about catalysis is having certain functional groups in juxtaposition. I already mentioned that. So for example, an oligosaccharide in this shape, its cyclodextrin, can be catalytic. Or even molecules that are juxtaposed by non-covalent bonds in lipid structures can be catalytic by way of having certain molecules near to each other that enhance the rate or catalyze certain reactions, as was published here and there. Fendler is a particularly important figure in this respect, but quite a few other papers have appeared. So what I'm saying is, for catalysis, we need the right chemicals, but we don't need the named polymers. It doesn't have to be a protein. It doesn't have to be an RNA. It can have any shape or kind, as long as you have the right groupings and the right juxtaposition in space. So when you look at what happens in many of the papers today, this can be a micelle or a vesicle with a watery inside. What happens here is that you can have pure lipids, or in many scenarios, like we heard from Giovanni, we can have a wall, and inside it have nucleic acids that carry information of the kind that we are used to see in cells today. In our own GARD, that's the name of the model immediately described, and Lipid World, we say there is only that, there is nothing inside, and this has diverse chemistry that can have catalytic effects and, as immediately to be described, can carry information and propagate it. Now, when we look at cells today, as we know them today, there are two types of complexity. One complexity is how many atoms there are in a molecule. And you can begin with a few dozen, and you can end with billions of atoms, like in a chromosome. A chromosome has it can have 10 to the 8 bases, and each base has a few dozen atoms. So we are talking about billions of atoms in one molecule. That's the way life has taken, perhaps later on, making longer and longer, more and more elaborate covalent structures. But there is also within every cell, in the lipid structures, and also inside the cytoplasm, and in the nucleus, everywhere, you have also ensemble complexity, in which you can have large or small molecules. Typically in cells today, you have relatively large molecules, like proteins in a ribosome, and making a supramolecular structure. But what is important is that these parts are bound together by weaker forces, non-covalent forces. And these non-covalent forces are the essence of life. What you make proteins for is to make specific non-covalent forces come to be, or non-covalent interactions. The GARD model, the graded autocatalysis replication model, is strongly based on ensemble complexity. But it goes to the extreme. It says that everything can happen with monomers. Now, what do we call monomers? In our own life, monomers are molecules up to, say, 100 atoms. And everything beyond that, particularly if you have repeating units, like in a protein or in nucleic acids, we call that a polymer. Lipid molecules are monomers. Amino acids are monomers. Can we have all three components of life as we know it today? Membranes, that is compartmentalization, metabolism, the web of molecular reactions, and templates or information containing molecules that can propagate information as we know it today in cells, can we have all of that done by small molecules? Remember, the question was large or small molecules. This is easy. Enclosure comes very cheap with small molecules. No covalent attachment of the entire membrane is needed. How nice. Catalysis, I argue, at least simple forms of catalysis can be done by monomers. What about information? That's crucial. We got to the most crucial point of my talk. Can you contain and propagate information with monomers only? Now, of course, if you think about information as residing in RNA or in a protein, you need to have threaded monomers. But can you do without that particular kind? And this is the model. It's a specific quantitative model for lipid world. It's called graded autocatalysis replication domain, or GARD. And the idea is, in its simplest embodiment, you have lipid catalysis. Remember that the head groups can be anything, so they can exert all sorts of catalytic effects. Monomers only, and importantly, compositional information, to be elaborated in a moment. So the model, in a snapshot, looks like this. You have a clump of matter, an aggregate, typically a micelle of lipid-like molecules. There is catalyzed homeostatic growth, joining of more molecules in a way that I call homeostatic. And again, in a nutshell, in a simplistic fashion, I will just say that this growth is directed into a particular corner in compositional space. What is compositional space? Maybe I will jump a few slides here. If you have a clump of matter, the vector that says how many of each kind is the compositional vector, and it defines a space of compositions. So you can have a lot of red and very little yellow and so on, and this will define which direction you go. And when I talk about homeostasis or homeostatic growth, what I mean is that this growth does something very peculiar, very unique, and that is there is an enhancement of the size of the clump, but it goes in the same direction in compositional space. So you need some internal forces that will do so. If you have random accretion, it will not happen. You have to have such a system in a simple-minded fashion. I will describe it as if you have a lot of red, red should join fast. If you have very few blues, blue should join slowly, and so on. So you remain in the same direction. Homeostatic growth, and then occasional fission. After we've seen those wonderful pictures of fission and tube formation and so on, beading, we don't need to apologize too much about that, the talk of Jack Szostak. So that's the essence of the GARD model in a qualitative fashion. And in a quantitative manner, what we regard or consider is a ball of molecules. Each of those molecules can exert rate enhancement effects on the entry and exit of molecules from the outside. All of them are assumed to come downhill in terms of free energy to form the clumps. So they favor being in the clump more than than being in the watery environment. But how fast they will go in and out, and remember, catalysis is always on both directions. So it cannot influence equilibrium, it can only influence steady state. So how fast they go in and out will depend on some basal rates, such as are shown here, plus catalytic effects in which, say, green will exert a catalytic effect on the entry and exit of blue. This comes to a set of differential equations, which we solve numerically by a stochastic chemistry type of a simulation. And what you have here are the basal rates, and this multiplying factor is the mutual catalysis, the beta matrix. Everything can catalyze everything. Of course, the beta matrix in reality will be quite sparse. Very few strong catalytic effects, quite a few small ones.
Well, use of catalysis here is bothersome.
Say it again?
Because, yeah,
use of catalysis.
Catalysis implies marked enhancements in reaction rates. And really, I think what you're proposing is that you have a surface that has some sort of hydrophobicity or some other aspect of it that captures another like molecule. It's more of a hydrophobic interaction that binds molecules like molecules like molecules. So like goes to like, and so you're simply binding molecules on a surface, and maybe as you do that, the surface changes its properties a little bit, and you expel something else that's less hydrophobic or something. But, you know, I don't see how that is catalysis. Catalysis is that you're remarkably accelerating a particular reaction towards a particular product. This is random chemistry.
I'm a gradation person. I don't believe in yes and no anywhere in science. So I preach for the idea that the word catalysis, if you wish, I will use another word. But for me, the word catalysis means the rate is enhanced. If the factor of enhancement is 1.001 or 10 to the 6, it is still, for me, the same phenomenon, only of a different degree. And what we show in our computer simulations is that when you have an ensemble of molecules, and when you have large or small rate enhancements that could come about, Jeff, from phenomena such as you describe, like hydrophobic, hydrophilic, but in the end, you would agree that if you have a large ensemble of different kinds of molecules, not all of them will do the same effect to all others. So if you have this matrix, each element will be different. Some will be very good, others worse. For example, the head groups, if one of them is positively charged and the other is negatively charged, you assume that there will be more attraction. If they are of the same charge, there will be more repelling, and it will be less good as pulling in something kind of help.
I mean, so you would be happy if one concedes that sort of the equilibrium composition differences.
But I'm not talking
of the strength of the
I'm not talking equilibrium.
Michael,
it's important, I stressed it and I will stress it again. At equilibrium, everything becomes absolutely boring and dead. It has to be away from equilibrium for these rate enhancements to be valid. It's like enzyme catalysis. Enzymes cannot affect a mixture. Suppose that there is an enzyme that transfers, that enhances the rate of A to B, and of course also of B to A. If they are at equilibrium, you add as much enzyme as you wish, they will remain the same ratio. But if you have only A, you can wait forever until B is, even a minuscule amount of B is formed. If you add a tiny amount of enzyme, suddenly A makes B in a much faster fashion. Now, in an ensemble kind of situation, this will translate into a very interesting dynamic behavior away from equilibrium. I will show it immediately.
What is keeping you away from equilibrium in your scenario?
Okay. Good question. You're asking good question. What keeps me away from equilibrium in this particular scenario is the following. If you let the molecules come in, enhanced by their rate or not, and you wait a long time, you end up with micelles at equilibrium with the molecules outside, and everything is dead. The only thing that will keep it away from equilibrium, a little bit like in some other dynamic models that we know, like the quasi-species model, you have to induce a steady state, for example, by taking molecules out or introducing molecules in, or in our case, a simple-minded situation in which the simulations usually go such that you have a clump, it grows, and we assume in the simulation that it splits into two when it reaches a certain size, and we only regard one of the split products and disregard the other, which chemically amounts to a dilution effect. That is, you throw one out of the vessel and you stay with one inside. And this keeps the system away from equilibrium. But you can think of all sorts of other embodiments to do the same. But it is important that if you do not simulate it, if in the back of your minds you don't remember always that it has one way or another to be kept away from equilibrium, nothing happens.
What you want here is a symmetry breaking mechanism, isn't it? Because if all the vessels were the same and you regard this ensemble, you still have some more green lumps, some more red ones, and so on.
If all beta were the same, it would be extremely boring. Yes.
Right.
If the matrix were populated with all the same numbers, identical numbers, then everything will be rather boring. Indeed, what we do, I will tell you about the population of the matrix so it will help. This is a question that leads to the next slide, which means that I'm giving a good talk. Always try to have your next slide answering the question on the previous slide. So the system as we have it here, that you have already seen, this is populated by a distribution. And the distribution is taken from a drug pharmacological type sets of experiments that in which people do random chemistry. So when you do, for example, a drug target, a protein, and you have a library of peptides or of RNA, small RNAs, or of random molecules of other types, and you challenge the target with a billion different types of molecules, some of them will bind, very few of them will bind strongly, and many, many others will bind less and less strongly. And this is a typical distribution. We've studied these distributions many years before I began my Origin of Life work. And in fact, I have to disclose a secret. It was this distribution that led me to try to think about the origins of life. So I really have to tell you about it. So this distribution can be true for affinity, which is an equilibrium measure of binding, or it can also be for catalysis. And you can do the transfer relatively easily if you think about it. And what you see here is a matrix that is populated by very few, as shown in the black here, very few strong. This is strong and weak, affinity or catalysis, catalytic power. So very few strong, more and more weak, and maybe fewer very, very weak. And that's the probability. So you use this probability distribution to populate the matrix, and we have in fact shown that if the matrix is not populated by what can be approximated to be a log normal distribution, I should say that this is a log scale here. So if you do not populate this way, things become boring, almost as boring as they would be if every element in the matrix were the same. So back to the qualitative drawing, the question is, what happens here? You have a clump of matter and it splits. If every molecule is different here, of course these two will be very, very different. If all the molecules here are the same, these two will be identical, but that's trivial. What happens if you have, let's say, five of each kind here? Then, even if the split is random, the two will be quite similar to each other. So there is a borderline in which you transit from a system in which there is absolutely no similarity among progeny to a situation where you have trivial similarity among progeny. And somewhere in the middle lies the interest of the GARD model. In order to generate a situation that this will be, as we call it in our jargon, splittable, namely breeding through and giving rise to two relatively similar progeny, of course not exactly similar, so these are already mutations in compositional space. So if you want to get to this state, you need to have this grow homeostatically. So homeostasis is important, not only in the sense that we are used to, that is, if a cell grows or stays homeostatic, it means that it doesn't change its internal conditions too much and it is alive, but it is also important that the process happens like you have in cell division, which I have here. What happens in cell division? You have replication of DNA, of course, but that's only one of the many molecules in a cell. The cell, by its internal mechanisms, by its metabolism, makes sure that when it gets to the point of needing to split, when it grows large enough and mature enough to become two, that every molecule has been copied amply so that the two progeny will be the same. So basically, every living cell inside your own bodies right now undergoes the same kind of homeostatic growth as these little creatures here, except that these do so without DNA and without RNA. Now, why do you need DNA and RNA? If you need to grow homeostatically, why do you need DNA? Can a cell grow homeostatically without DNA?
One of my cells? No.
Well, it can, as long as the molecules are simple. The moment you need very complex molecules, then you need an instructor. So homeostatic growth in today's cells requires the polymers that we call DNA and RNA. But this is because it has gone to the point of generating catalysts that are extremely efficient by making some other type of polymer that we call protein. But if you start with very small molecules and they undergo the same process that I have described to you now, then you don't need DNA and RNA. So that's sort of the break point. Either you believe in it or you don't believe in it. But we say that this is like cellular replication. It's much less efficient, it's much more error prone, but it is still a valid depiction.
What's the difference between that and crystal growth?
Crystal growth is like what I mentioned before, when you have all the same kind of molecule.
These are the same.
No, they're all different colors.
Well, there's a high defined kind. They're not identical. They're similar chemistry, but they're not identical.
This is one of the pitfalls that one always encounters when talking about life. Is a crystal alive? We all agree it ain't, but sometimes we serve as devil's advocates, either for ourselves or for others, asking about crystals. It's a very valid question. But crystals, A, are not dynamic, B, are all of the same kind in most cases, all of the same kind of molecules. They are geometrically very stringent. Here there is a lot of flexibility, which...
Crystals don't evolve.
Exactly, because of all that I have said before.
And these evolve.
Yes, we say that they do.
These aren't intrinsically dynamic. You've got something mysterious that's keeping it out of equilibrium.
No, not mysterious. It's something that can happen under very natural conditions.
No, okay, but it's something external
that can't be changing. Let me interject. Any scenario for the origin of life, any scenario for life will have, by definition, to assume a mechanism that will keep a system away from equilibrium. So we are not unusual in that respect.
The crystal is also being held away from equilibrium. Then you can't use it of not being dynamic.
I wish to leave the crystal alone now. Okay, it's some kind of an absurdum kind of argument that I enjoy thinking about in the night, but it will not lead to a better understanding of life. Let's leave it alone for a moment. Yes.
An important aspect of life that makes it non-equilibrium is that there is a flux of energy coming from the sun or from thermal vents. So is this somehow reflected in the model?
Good question. In future embodiments, it will be. What is nice is that we have shown that you don't need any energy of the usual kinds. You only need a little bit of mechanical energy that will disrupt and some kind of a dilution effect for a neighborhood to be away from equilibrium. But of course, it will be very nice. Now, I have one more thing to say. You have to make those molecules, and for making the molecules, you may need energy. But once you have the molecules, you can, in the simplest embodiment of a model such as that, you don't need energy of light. But it would be extremely nice to add this later.
Let me ask another question about these monomers. You've got a handful of monomers up there, and I would suggest in any kind of prebiotic environment, you're going to have a zillion monomers of all different flavors. You're going to have enantiomers. You're going to have diastereomers. You're going to have isomers. And it's just a zoo of molecules. And so if you put a zoo of molecules in this, you're not going to have just a few molecules binding here. You're going to have billions of different molecules binding in different places on the surface. And every time you split one of these things, you're going to have another different zillion kind of molecules.
This is what is so nice about the model. The model assumes there is a zillion, and it argues the following, that if you have a soup full of zillions of molecules, many, many such clumps will form. Most of them, upon impinging of other molecules, will do something completely random. A few of them, because of their internal makeup, will be such that will undergo homeostatic growth and will begin an evolution-like process. Now, once you have such a clump, by its internal mechanism, it will reject the noisy molecules from outside, and it will only accept those that are suitable for the homeostatic growth. Now, we are not asking for every clump to do that. We are asking for a very small fraction of clumps to do so. And they will be the precursors of life. So that's the idea.
It depends on these betas, right?
Yes.
Because like you're saying there is this growth which sort of preserves the information.
Correct.
Content, and then there's a diffusive step of confusion.
Yes, yes.
And so so you jump again in composition,
yes,
space. Okay. So there should be something like a quasi species.
You can translate it into quasi species dynamics.
Are the betas in any way big enough so that the diffusion that you get again from fission is not randomizing them?
Okay, let me answer this in the following fashion. You are absolutely right, Michael. There are hurdles. What we are trying to draw is a scenario that is every scenario for the origin of life is exposed to the same problems of dilution, of noise, of decomposition, and so on. It's always the problem of how to emerge out of this sea, or a hostile sea of effects.
Right.
So what I'm saying is, here is a scenario which does not require molecules that in themselves are extremely sensitive to such noise, such as an RNA molecule, and still, so they are more stable, the molecules themselves are more stable, the aggregates are more stable, and you can begin a process in which evolution itself will counter the noise.
I mean, I agree. I mean, in some sense, my question was just a variant of Jeffrey's before about what catalysis is. So if it's 0.01, it's not going to work. If it's 10 to the 6, then it's going to work.
Most will be 0.01, and very few will be up here. Okay. So the few will make the clump that is the winner. The combination of a few. So it's a question of combination. It's combinatorics. You have to have just the right amount and just the right kinds to get a homeostatic micelle. So suppose you have 10 to the 8 different kinds of molecules. You may have subsets of, say, 2,000 molecules which are homeostatic. There are many, many ways of doing such subsets. Very few of them will be homeostatic. It's a question of probability. But at least you show a trajectory from a gemisch, from a soup, to something that undergoes a rudimentary process of evolution without assuming biopolymers.
I guess I'm what's called an philosophical side of this. This is a very general model, and let's say plausible. How can it be?
You said it's implausible?
Plausible.
Okay.
Very plausible.
How do you prove it?
Yeah. How can it be wrong?
Yes. It can be wrong.
Can you really tell us how it can be wrong? You know, how can it be falsified?
I will talk about it towards the end of the talk. Remind me to mention this specifically when I talk about what I call the computational origin of life endeavor. So.
Not entirely relevant, but I keep going through the mental fantasy about a lipid organism having the same discussion about
RNA. Correct. Okay, so just in a nutshell again, compositional information versus sequence-based information, combinatorics of two different kinds, a definition of compositional space, just to convince you that there is information in composition. You have this amount, how this many bits of information in a 10 long stretch with a 20 strong alphabet, same 20 strong alphabet, 10 long quote unquote clump that is non-covalently adhered together or bound together, has 24 bits of information. So it's not different orders of magnitude. So you can send a message by a clump. And this I already said. So now to the dynamics. The dynamics is along the lines that I've already mentioned. You start with any random composition, and it will get attracted to certain fixed points in or quasi-stationary states that we call composomes. And this word comes from compositional genomes in the sense that we consider this point in space, which is undergoes homeostatic growth and then can undergo split and giving rise to sort of bred through progeny, that this point is like an attractor. The system gets there. There is more than one such point, and these points contain their own genome, so to speak. That's why we call them composome. A composome has reduced repertoire. We have already said that. A billion outside, maybe a few thousand inside for the successful ones, for the lucky ones. The composome has NE much smaller than NG. NG is the size of the alphabet. NE is how many of, actually this should be, yeah, okay. NE is how many types we have. This is the alphabet. This is how many types we have inside. So this is much smaller than that. So the environment has a large repertoire. The inside has a small repertoire. This is a restriction of repertoire that we are all looking for a mechanism for when we talk about life. Because again, remember the first sentences that I uttered, you are looking at life with very few types of molecules. The outside environment has many, many more. You can think of abiotic mechanisms. You can think of biotic mechanisms. We think about a mesobiotic mechanism. That is, you begin to go in the direction of evolution and selection by way of what I have described to you, and you go from a large repertoire to a restricted repertoire. Incidentally, and not for the talk today, because Jeff mentioned enantiomers, it's exactly the same. You can show enantioselection in GARD, just like you get selection among different kinds of molecules. And as a sort of an interim joke, although maybe it's not a joke, remember the Martian meteorite that I described to you in the first talk, these worm-like structures and the restricted a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon spectrum. So now we are a bit more ready to understand why restriction is important. If you're random, if you go up to Mars, one of the things you have to look for, and we heard to a degree, we heard a hint in this direction from Jeff, you have to look for a restriction of repertoire. What Jeff said was perhaps everything will be D. That's one kind of restriction of repertoire. Or he also said maybe there will be a few types of amino acids versus others that will not appear in a particular sample. That's a restriction of repertoire. And this Martian meteorite, at least reported in the Science paper of 1996, had a restricted repertoire of this type of molecules, of these polyring carbon compounds that look like small portions of fullerene. So anyway, this was also mentioned in the previous talk. This is, in the eyes of many, too small because it cannot contain the ribosomes and the RNA polymerase and so on and so forth, all the structures that are necessary for life as we know it today, but perhaps they are guardobes and they don't need all of these mechanisms so they can be smaller. Now you can simulate evolution in the core of the computer, and the three different colors are different composomes, and you can see the transitions and you can see the splits. This is a particular situation in which we did keep more than one progeny at each split. Already mentioned. Okay. Because I didn't want to go into all the formal details, I didn't bring these slides. But let me mention it in a nutshell. You are in one point of compositional space. That's what the simulations show, that we call a composome, which means that it stays there for quite a long time. You have a growth, split steps, and you still are in the same region of space, compositional space. Then, because the system is noisy, and good that it is, it undergoes a series of compositional mutations, and it begins to drift away, and then it falls into another location in compositional space in which it is also homeostatic, and that's a different composome. So we can actually watch things happen, going from one composome to another in an evolution-like process.
So you're saying that these attractors, they are not, at some point they are destroyed by noise again. And then
yes.
You go to, it's for a while it stays in some Okay.
Yes. And in the process in which it goes from one to another is slightly like speciation. Now, I have to disclose to you a problem of the model as we have it now. The present embodiment of the model is not open-ended. That is, it has a particular number of composome types. We call them compotypes. If you do clustering on the composomes, you can cluster them into different families. And let's say that we have between 3 and 10 compotypes in a typical simulation. And it will always roam among these compotypes. So it's not open-ended evolution. But our strong suspicion is that as we add larger and larger complexity forming devices into the model, that we will get better open-endedness. And I will tell you more about it in a few moments.
Question?
Yes.
Is it true that the duration a composome stays in one region of your space is dependent on the beta matrix?
Everything depends on the beta matrix.
Right. So, but then, so I mean, what kind of time scales do you get realistically for catalytic rates, which are, so how much does it depend on sampling from your distribution, fitting the matrix? Do you get huge dynamic range in these times?
You're asking what happens if we sample many times from the same distribution?
Yeah.
Depends on how big the matrix is. If the matrix is relatively large, then it tends to level off. But typically, we don't use very large matrices, and the matrices can be quite different from each other, and we get a very large diversity of behaviors. So you can have, for example, some cases, you have a very large diagonal value, which means an autocatalyst. So one molecule that enhances the rate of its own absorption into the clump, into the micelle. In that case, we get a relatively boring case of almost everything is populated by this autocatalyst. On the other hand, in some other cases, we get more interesting behaviors. So indeed, things do depend on the sampling of beta. What we also, IAOs in my laboratory is now exploring the question of how the initial conditions influence. So there is a relatively weak influence of initial conditions in the present embodiment. But if we go to larger NG, that is alphabets, and if we use, we use larger matrices, and particularly, as we are now attempting, and I will immediately describe, if we add complexification, that is not only molecules coming in and out, but also molecules can bind together and form oligomers en route to a polymer world, then we believe we are beginning to see more interesting behaviors and also more diverse behaviors. So the beta matrix is now becoming much more complex because it's not only how much each influences the entry and exit, but also each molecule can influence the binding covalently of two others in an oligomerization step. You get a very large beta matrix, and then a lot of interesting things can happen. Let me show that to you. So this I already mentioned, right, that only a few are the lucky ones, and it gives you some kind of a tool to compute what we call a planetary probability. For example, if we can ask the question of what is the probability to get certain replicators. For example, a bad replicator will be relatively frequent. A very good replicator will be very infrequent. We can compute by the size of the Earth and by the size of a micelle how many instances of micelles we can have on an entire Earth. Of course, that's a large oversimplification, but at least it gives you numbers. The numbers that we get are in the range of, let's say, 10 to the minus 30 or so. So 10 to the minus 40 is something that may never happen. This is taking into account the size of micelle, the size of the planet, and the amount in years that is available for the game. If we take all of this into account, we can get to, let's say, something that has a probability of 10 to the minus 30, but not of 10 to the minus 40. So it's a tool that can be used, a conceptual tool, that can be used to ask questions such as, how prevalent is life in the universe once we have the real parameters? And how to get the real parameters, I will tell you immediately. So the summary here, for these 3 points, catalysis is not only by proteins, it can be affected by something like a lipid-like molecule. Large molecule or small, we are happy that we can see something interesting happening with only small molecules, because this makes life much simpler for a person that needs to understand how life began. And sequential or compositional information, we think that compositional information, which prevails in cells until today, was extremely important and was perhaps the only game in town early on. Single molecules or networks. The last part of my talk will address this. Remember, I mentioned that we are going to talk about networks. I don't have time to say everything, but I will just say that we are trying to think in terms of systems prebiology. Systems biology itself is understanding cells and organisms as complete, highly complex entities with all the parameters being considered. Prebiotic entities may have acquired systems properties very early on. So what we say, instead of having single molecules, we are talking about ensembles of molecules right from the start. The ensembles of molecules are indeed networks, as I will immediately tell you. And so we are talking about systems right from the start. We are not the first ones to have said that. Freeman Dyson, in his newer version and also in the older version of his book, Origin of Life, has said things like that. It's a toy model in which systems of recombining monomers, with some of which are alive and some of which are dead. It's a real toy model, but with plausible parameter values, a jump to an organized state can happen, and the Darwinian selection can then drive towards greater complexity. This is Dyson. Stuart Kaufman, in two or more books, has described this scenario in which there are foodstuff molecules that form oligomers. So here there is already oligomerization, but it is not absolutely necessary. And the idea is that there is a mutually catalytic network where every molecule can catalyze at least one reaction inside the test tube. And he shows, Stuart Kaufman shows, that if you have enough molecules, everything will catalyze everything. Now, one of the drawbacks of Stuart's model is that he doesn't quantitate this. That is, he doesn't ask how strong the catalysis will be. He only asks whether or not there will be catalysis. And this gives rise to some kind of a problem, a mathematical problem. But if you use the graded response that we are describing, then this model translates into a very well-behaved right. model.
Dorian, how does something like that evolve?
This, the network.
You got, right.
Okay.
I mean, if one of those errors evolve, we have like some new reaction, there's no feedback.
The whole system, the network in Stuart's thinking, is an entity that can make more of itself. He didn't show it directly. Okay. We decided to leave the crystal alone. The crystal does that. You can say the same about RNA.
Evolution seems to be a key.
Let's concentrate on criticisms that can only be directed to this. Okay? Because if you say a crystal can replicate itself, you can say that to the RNA person as well. So let me say a few more words about this before I go back to what we preach for. This is a network in which a lot of catalytic events occur. Stuart Kaufman argued, not always proving it absolutely to the end, that if everything catalyzes everything, then there is some kind of a catalytic closure and the system begins to behave like a live organism. And of course, it's not perfect, so there might be mutations and so on. What we took from him was the idea of everything catalyzes everything, but we instilled it into a model which is much more quantitative and much more simulatable. And the model, therefore, assumes not that every molecule, in Stuart's thinking, and that's a criticism that has been directed against him, every molecule has to be present at the same place at the same time to get catalytic closure. What we argue for is a weaker argument. We say, there is a very large matrix of the total chemistry possible, out of which you sample a small subset of molecules, and many of the subsamples will be stupidly dull, and very few of them will be homeostatic and therefore begin to behave like life. So it's a slightly different way of thinking. Now, each of the composomes, this is the composome, how many of each kind, so it's a histogram of the composome. Very little here, a lot of this material, very few here, quite a few of these, and so on. Each of those can be seen as a network because each of those molecules interacts with all the others at different strengths. The strength now depends A, on the beta matrix value, and B, on how much there is of each of the molecules, the catalyzed and the catalyzing. So you have networks that you can draw, and you can look at network motifs and so on. Please notice that these are not circles. It's not like a hypercircle, or hypercycle. It's a network, and it has What you see here, it's only part of the network because we only show the stronger catalytic effects. And the network can undergo evolution-like processes, as was shown already in 1998 by my student Daniel Segre. And it even shows a measure of what is known as punctuated equilibrium. That is, under a certain set of conditions, it will undergo fast evolution, and then it will get into a plateau, and then it will change again and again. And there is a power law in the number of changes that occurs a long time. And this is the real depiction of what happens. You start with something that looks like this. You end up with something that looks like that. You transit through an intermediate. Each of those is a network. Each of them has a certain capacity to undergo homeostatic growth, but it can change from one time point to another. Okay, because of the lack of time, and because I want to hear more questions, I'm going to skip some of the ideas. There is a whole story here about power laws. Let me just mention, I will just say that since we are going to hear a lot about networks, this will serve as a very, very quick introduction. When you have a network, this is a simple-minded network. All arrows are the same thickness, and the nodes, the elements can be of different or similar sequence, depends. In any event, you can ask for each of the nodes how many connections it has. It can be out degree and in degree. How many out arrows, how many in arrows? You can count all of those. You can do a distribution of K, which is how many contacts each node has. And in a random network, this will look like a bell-shaped curve. In a network such as we see in living organisms and also in the internet and also in social interactions and so on, and this is much of the teachings of Barabashi and colleagues and others, you get a power law, which means that there are very few nodes that are very strongly connected and a lot of nodes that are very weakly connected. So you get this kind of linear behavior on a log-log scale. GARD does not behave like this at the moment, but we hope it will soon. But there is one measure that does behave like this, and that is Ni, the count of the nth type of molecule. So when you draw how many, if you look at the clump of matter, you ask how many have a count of 1, how many have a count of 2, and how many have a count of 100, and so on, you get a power law when you do a statistics over many. So the individual GARD traces show relatively noisy behavior, but if you sum them all up, you get a very, very beautiful power law, which means that you have a lot of molecules with very small population, 1 or 2 or 3, and very, very few molecules on average that have a very large number of copies in the compositional assembly. Now, Barabashi and colleagues and many others have shown that a scale-free network, which is just a nickname for this power law, the word scale-free means that there is no typical value, that the typical value will be if the distribution is like that. If it's like that, there is no typical value, so it's scale-free. This scale-free behavior comes out of phenomena that can be depicted as rich gets richer. So if you have some that are successful, they become more successful and even more successful, and they become very well connected. And he showed it in a very quantitative fashion. He showed that the model reduces to scale-free model power law connectivity distribution observed in diverse systems. So he assumed a certain law, mathematical law, about recruitment of contacts, and he showed that this law ends up with power law behavior. And what we see in our own model, we rationalize this power law of the distribution of instances of how many copies there are of each kind. This is actually coming out of the homeostatic growth. Remember, I said if you have a lot of reds, you should be a very strong recruiter for red. If you have very few green, very weak recruiter for green. So this is like the rich gets richer, and hence the power law that we see. And not only that, the power law is not only a result, but it is also a cause for a good splitability. Because if there is a power law, there will be many compounds that will be present in a relatively large number of copies, hence you can make faithful progeny.
So what's the hang-up here on power laws and also the long tail of distribution?
You're asking why is it important at all?
I mean, you want some tail in the distribution, right? I mean, that's why you're so keen on getting all of this. I mean,
well, it's a good point. It's a good point. All biological systems behave like that. So does it mean that if you have power law that you are biology? I don't know. You're right. It's not. We shouldn't make too much of it. You're right.
But it's non-biological systems have power law.
Correct. So that does it mean that this is non-biological? Oh.
Arguable that some of the networks, biological networks, have power law behavior or not. You can fix some of these things are really cool.
I agree. So what you're saying is, generally speaking, let's not talk too much about power laws.
There's a paper of Kostehanen on the subject.
What?
We examine the data. There's a paper of Kostehanen.
That?
We're examining this data. Yeah. And he's actually a mathematician.
Yes.
Very good. And they're concluding that the probability of this set being drawn from power law distribution is zero.
You are concluding this.
What?
What kind of system is it? What you're saying is that some people
I confess, I haven't read the past abstract, but I thought the abstract was very nice.
So some people claim power laws when such does do not exist.
Yeah, I think you may discuss
another going back to life. One other nice game that we can play. Since each of the compositional assemblies is a network, we can ask questions about what happens with mutations. In fact, this curve that I showed you from the paper in 98, this one, was actually a first embodiment, an early embodiment of a mutation-like process in which we took the very one molecule and added another one. So it's also something that we do today in such networks. And what is nice to watch is how the network readjusts when you take away a molecule. And you can ask how robust the network is for such eliminations of molecules. And like you see in much more elaborate systems, such as yeast, when you ask about genes, whether or not they affect the phenotype in a strong fashion when mutated away, when knocked out, you can do the same here. It's sort of a simple model for a biological network. A link is the catalysis.
The beta.
It's beta times the concentrations. Because in chemistry, it's always like that the phenomenon depends on the concentrations and also on the rate constants, all the catalytic constants.
You're talking about concentrations in bulk?
In the assembly.
In the assembly. And you're assuming the concentrations in the bulk are unperturbed by this assembly?
We are very often assume buffering on the outside. Not necessarily. We have some simulations in which we assume a limited amount of compounds outside. It modifies the behavior, sometimes in interesting ways. So we do this mutation kind of game, and we get something like that. So we have sometimes mutations enhance the growth rate, which is some kind of a phenotype. Very often they don't do too much, and some of them give rise to sickness or to lethality. That is, they diminish the growth rate in a very strict, strong fashion. And we can learn something interesting from those distributions. That is, how for different beta matrices, for different sets of assumptions, how strong or weak is the network when it comes to mutating it away. And we have begun recently to look even at double mutations with respect to something that is known as synthetic lethality. That is, you're lethal only if two of them are mutated, and when only one, either this or the other, nothing happens. Now, I want to finish by saying that, again, something that is a matter of principle. And the matter of principle is as follows. If we look at the RNA world scenario, we assume there was a very lucky replicator, which was a single molecule, and somehow from here to what we know we should get to, which is present-day cells with their elaborate networks, there must have been a growth in terms of the number of nodes in the network. What we argue in the alternative scenario is that it goes the other way around. In fact, there were many more nodes. It's not shown here, but there may have been many more nodes in the network. And what goes up is the fidelity. That is, the catalytic powers become stronger and stronger as you go on and on in evolution. How can that happen? And this, towards the end of my talk, is just a way to introduce the idea that we begin to show what happens when you have oligomerization. The assumption of all of us is that oligomers are better catalysts than monomers because of the way to juxtapose different groups by a folding type device. So we begin to look at that. We then, without artificiality, allow ourselves to change the beta matrix into better catalytic powers. We also introduce something like folding. So if you have an oligomer, the catalytic power may be affected not necessarily by adjacent groups or monomers, but by remote ones. So this is another level of complexity. When we add all of this, we begin to see interesting behaviors. This is only by adding monomers to trimers. It's called trimer guard. It's a very, very simple model of oligomerization. What you see here in each row is one of the compotypes. So this is a composome type 4, type 5, and so on. And this is time. What happened?
I'm very bad.
You're really bad. When you give a lecture, I'll show jokes too. No, it's okay. So to make a long story short about what we see here, this is time axis, the number of generations that have elapsed, and this is where you are in the composome. So at every point, like at point... I feel like an elementary school teacher. I'll throw you out. I'll have you stand in a corner.
I spend many of my classroom hours in the corner.
Now I understand. But the corner is not a solution because you continue to talk from there. You have to go out.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Why did you let me talk at 5 afternoon? It's time. Okay, so at time point or generation 1000, this is a very long simulation, so you cannot really see the fine grain. But at each point in time, it is spending time in only one of these. And you can see a long-term behavior in which, for some reason, this composome type number 10 is very strong between here and there, but then it becomes weak and then strong again and then weak again. And you can do a second level analysis on a space which is constructed from these 11 composomes, compotypes as we call them. And you see a behavior which is quite interesting. It spends a lot of time in a certain region of reduced dimensionality space in this PCA analysis, principal component analysis, but suddenly it can move very far away. So it means that a long time, there is a question that I did not get into, which has to do with ergodicity. That is, does the system repeat itself again and again, or does something new and interesting happen? And life is not ergodic. It continuously generates new possibilities and new configurations. And we, without going into details, we begin to see a glimpse of that happening here.
Saying that life is ergodic, doesn't that have to do with the finiteness of time elapsed?
Yeah, ergodicity is the comparison between what happens if you look at many instances over short time as opposed to one instance over a very long time. So the assumption is, that's one way of defining it. The assumption is that if you're ergodic, you end up repeating yourself so that if you sample long enough, you'll see again and again the same instances.
If the number of possible instances are large compared to the amount of time,
then you behave like non-ergodic. Of course, there is a finite number of possibilities to construct me or to construct entities out of the atoms that are contained within me. But it's a very, very large number indeed. So we behave like we are open-ended. So I will finish with a prediction, and that is understandability by in silico analysis or not. Many people come to me and say, well, this is all nice and well, but it is only simulations. What about experiments? I would like to make the following statement. Test tube experiments are extremely important. But if we want to test our model, and that's a question of testability or rejecting the model, we will have to do a lot of microanalysis of numerous ensembles of molecules and ask questions about their dynamics. Probably the present type chemistry and the present type of patients that we have, we need to finish an experiment within a month or so, is not suitable for doing that. Maybe the kind of experiments that will be done in the end for origins of life will be those which will be handed over from one generation to another. So a graduate student will start it now, and in a century, somebody will come back to see what happens. This sounds stupid, but it may not be completely idiotic.
Then you post the PhD diplomas on the grave?
Or maybe you extend the lifespan. Now, what is more plausible? What?
Hitchhikers. The galaxy problem, that the result will be not known after 100 years, but people will have forgotten what the question is.
Right, when the answer will be 42. So, galactic travel is much more plausible, although I don't know when it will become really feasible. If we go, there are 10 to the 11 suns here, as mentioned already, and quite a few planets that might be interesting. If we were able to visit every one of them, we will probably get a very nice sample of what life can be and what life is. But it will take time. So we may end up knowing a lot, but you have to be patient for that as well. So if you are impatient, I think that's possibly the only way. Large-scale, chemistry-realistic computer simulations. And I want to end my talk by saying that there is a thriving endeavor that is called artificial life, which deals with games such as Conway's Game of Life and some other embodiments that are not like life. What we are preaching for is doing similar analysis, except with tools that allow us to do real chemistry, something that begins today with what is known as molecular dynamics. So, the idea is that maybe we will be able, before we travel galactically, before we do experiments that take a million years to finish, maybe we will be able, with the advent of computers and with Moore's law and with planet-sized computers that are emerging with the internet, maybe we will be able to do experiments in silico test tube that will allow us to follow a trajectory all the way from this to this entity that I showed you the fossil of in the previous lecture. Now, we take it quite simply and for granted that you can simulate in the test tube something that you cannot, sorry, that you can simulate in a computer something you cannot really put in a test tube, such as the Big Bang, galaxy formation, planet formation, star formation, and so on. We ask for experiments here because we know these are molecules and we can do experiments with them, but maybe it's not plausible. And we wrote a paper about it that is called The Computational Origin of Life Endeavor. We did some computations. I don't have time to go into that. This is time scale between here and let's say 60 years or so from now, and how strong computing power will be and what you can achieve with that. But the bottom line is this: conjecture. The in silico chemistry of 2035 or 2055 may provide a highly accurate reenactment of protein folding, enzyme specificity, as well as prebiotic scenarios. So like we hope one day, perhaps pretty soon, we will be able to completely simulate an enzyme and understand in all its detail the relationship between a particular configuration of atoms and the dynamics that is carried out by it. Perhaps we will be also able to go from such simple entities to larger and larger, more and more complex entities until we understand how life began. So, the chicken and egg, maybe the guard model will serve as a chick egg. This is a real drawing that I took out of the internet. That's the woman who drew it. So this chick egg may be the guard model, and it embodies together membranes, templates, and metabolism. Metabolism-like networks, information in the compositional form, it has compartments in a very natural fashion, it's capable of rudimentary reproduction, it's capable of rudimentary transmission of information with mutations, and of primitive evolution, therefore, and it can be made gradually more and more elaborate, and with enough computing power, maybe we will see life emerging in silico one day. These are the people who did the work. Thank you.
your comment now and how it can be wrong?
Yes. If I take it to the extreme, there is nothing but guard, because guard is a general way of looking at interaction among molecules. You can make it as elaborate as you wish. You can introduce as many aspects of folding, of structure, of different functionalities. If you do it in a real molecular dynamics fashion, if you really do the chemistry in silico, as opposed to what we do today, which is imaginary chemistry, then there is nothing else. Then you just look at accretion and games that molecules play. So I don't see exactly what is there to prove wrong. You can prove wrong. What? No, I mean, if life exists and if we do not assume something supernatural, then it must have emerged from an interaction among molecules. And we have all the right, in this concoction, we have all the right ingredients, that is, being away from equilibrium.
Can I actually ask someone? So, clearly, your answer is that you can't be wrong. But can I ask a simple question? Jack yesterday was, doing much more modest things than reenacting all of life. What I read here is the statement that it actually might be easier to get started with some modest steps by attaching some good things to lipids.
There is nothing like hold on, boys. But you, this is a misnomer. There is nothing like attaching good things to lipids. A lipid can contain any head group you wish.
That's right. I'm just okay. So the question is, if you think it was easier to do it that way, then is it reasonable for me to deduce from that that it's also easier for it to try to do it like that now? Which is to say that the practical suggestion for Jack's lab is to attach whatever. Do whatever he does.
Yes,
with
okay.
Molecules.
Yes.
Can you think of some practical suggestion of some small number of molecules that will provide you with some rudimentary combinatorial complexity to do some screens that something non-trivial will come out?
First, I'm doing my own experiments along these lines, because in the end I'm also an experimentalist. So together with Martin Hanchik, who was a PhD student of Jack Szostak, I'm doing now a set of experiments also with Yomo in Japan. We are trying to do some experiments in which we do exactly that. That is, we are putting together a modest number of different types of lipids, some of them fluorescently labeled, and asking basic questions about the dynamic behavior. It's a long road, but we ask questions such as, can one lipid influence the entry and exit of some other lipids? So this is like the very basic element of the model, just questioning that in an experimental way. Now, what would I suggest to people like Szostak in terms of doing work on lipids? Well, most people, in the final account, look at lipids as mundane wall makers, and they sort of refuse, mentally and otherwise, to look at them as the important elements in the equation. So if I could convince someone to do away with nucleic acids and just ask questions about how lipids behave, I actually asked that to Jack in his lecture. I asked a simple question such as, you are now using one kind of lipid, what happens if you use many types of lipids? And he said he was doing that. But the low-tech aspect of using many lipids is just asking how the enclosure is affected, the efficiency of the enclosing wall is affected by heterogeneity of lipids. What we want to do is to go one step further and to ask how the actual dynamics is affected when the lipid is the game itself. And that's something that is very difficult to convince people to do.
Uh, Okay, so, yeah, more comments. Whoever wants to really know what life is should join us for dinner. Whoever wants to really know what life is should join us for dinner.